Chapter 7. "Forgive me for bursting in on you at this time of day," said Stephen, "but I'm in sad need of the melee for mercury sublimate, strontium nitride and antimony." "Pedoc and Dartang for the first two," said Van Buren, "but I'm afraid strontium isn't yet known in these parts. Has it any therapeutic value?"
"None that I know of. Fireworks are what I have in mind, and it gives a noble red.
As for that, there are no less than 3 Chinese cracker makers on the other side of the river, and they have the whole spectrum at their command. Lao Tung is said to be the best. I would come with you, but as I said in my note, I'm away at noon, and I must finish this creature before I go."
"Of course, Lao Tung. Many thanks indeed. We are to receive the Sultan this evening on the occasion of Princess Sophia's birthday, and it occurred to me that a brilliant royal salute in her honour would not only give pleasure, but would emphasise the mission's loyalty as opposed to Ledwa's open treason, and make an evident contrast between, on the one hand, a set of men who deserted first their king and then their republic, and who now support a vile usurper, and, on the other, a set who have consistently supported the hereditary principle, which must surely appeal to a ruler by divine right." Fox agrees. "By the way, am I right in supposing that His Highness is a pederast?"
"Oh, yes, didn't I mention it? Perhaps I never thought of anything so obvious. Such things are as usual here as they were in Athens. The present favourite is one Abdul. I've rarely seen a man so besotted."
"He's a pretty youth, sure.
But that to one side. I had a most satisfactory meeting with the Pondicherry clerk in the night."
"Duplessis Pondicherry clerk?"
"Just so. Le Sir is his name. Wuhan's young man, to whom he is deeply in debt, brought him in the darkness, and we soon came to an agreement. He has an importing and exporting house in Pondicherry, where his family still lives. And in exchange for our good word with the company, our protection for the future and a certain amount of present money, he undertook to give me what information he could. He sent these this morning. They are the rough draft of Duplessis' official journal, which Le Sir writes out fair."
Van Buren put down his scalpel, wiped his hands and took the sheaf of paper. He read intently, and after a page or two he said, "I see that our contact is looked upon as purely scientific."
"Yes. Fox wanted to come and see you to talk about the Buddhist temple at Kumai, but I pointed out that a visit by the envoy might compromise the position. Aubrey, too, was anxious to be introduced, which reminds me I have an appointment with him for 20 minutes after 9 o'clock.
Said Stephen, looking at his watch.
"Jesus, Mary and Joseph, it's 9:45. He's a raging lion if he's kept waiting even as little as 30 minutes. I wish you both a very good journey. God bless. I'll show you the papers again. Forgive me. Oh, dear, oh, dear."
Jack, with the purser, the purser's steward, Killick and Bondon, were at Liu Liang's at Stephen's recommendation, laying in stores for the Diane's reception that evening, served by Liu Liang himself. They had waited for Stephen 11 minutes at the landing place, and had then made their way to Liu Liang's by a route that led them through the hog market, escorted by a cloud of ribald children. And they greeted him with a reserved severity, pursed lips and significant looks at their watches, or, in default of watches, at a Chinese clepsydra by the dried medicinal serpents. Liu Liang, however, was as welcoming as could be, and once the stores were laid in, he sent an assistant to show the way to the firework maker. Jack and Stephen made the journey by themselves, Mr. Blythe and the others returning to the ship. They crossed the bridge and followed the guide up a street leading away from the river, shops on one side, and open drains with many small black nimble pigs in the middle, the long wall of the French envoy's compound on the other. And 100 yards ahead, they saw Ray and Ledwood walking arm in arm. As soon as he saw them, Ray let go. He darted across the street, leaping the gutter and hurrying blindly into a clothes shop. Ledwood walked on, his face set and tense. Stephen glanced at Jack. No apparent awareness, only a remote gravity. Ledward deviated slightly from his course, giving the wall, and they passed. The Pedoc, the Datang, and substances warranted to give a brilliant red and a brilliant blue were weighed out and packed in small cotton bags, each labelled with a coloured twist. There was little conversation on the way down to the sea, but as they walked out along the crater rim, charmingly fresh after the close, damp and very smelly heat of Prabang, Stephen said, "What do you feel about those two?" "Only disgust." "You wouldn't kick Ledward, for example?" "No, would you?" Stephen paused and said, "Kick him?" "No. On reflection, no." Some minutes of silent walking on the soft, crumbled lava, and then as they passed the stunted tree by which he had met Le Sœur, the Pondicherry clerk, he said, "Were there a white stone anywhere at hand, I should use it to mark this day. I brought off what may prove a useful stroke in my own line." "I'm heartily glad of it," said Jack. And stopping to fill his powerful lungs, he put up one hand as a speaking trumpet and hailed, "Diane ahoy!" Watching the boat put off, he added, "No white stones, all as black as you had. But at least we can break out a case of Hermitage. I'm sure it will not mind the heat." Stephen, his heart and belly aglow with the Hermitage, spent the later afternoon with Mr. White, the gunner, in the forward magazine and the filling room, fairly cool below the waterline, measuring, weighing and trundling the deadly little barrels to and fro. "I do assure you, Master Gunner," he kept repeating, "it can do your guns no harm. The captain has used the same mixture before broadside after broadside. I saw it with my own eyes from the stock of a pyrotechnician deceased. And sure, it is guns no harm. Beside, it is only for the salute. We shoot at the targets with your best long-distance red large grain." "Well, I don't know, I'm sure," said Mr. White once more, privately conveying a little antimony out of the scales. "But if chemicals, Chinese chemicals, don't honeycomb a gun, what does? And a gun honeycombed with chemicals, Chinese chemicals, and that is liable to burst." He and his mates were the only dismal creatures in the ship, however. Most of the Dianes, sadly bored with lying at anchor, looked forward to the Sultan's visit with pleasure. They had, of course, scoured the frigate from truck to keelson, and now, having prepared four elegant, lofty targets trimmed with bunting on staves as long as the carpenter could be brought to spare, they were carefully chipping their round shot so that no unevenness should make the ball deviate from its mark. The ship was filled with the gentle sound of tapping hammers, interrupted from time to time by the crack of Fox's rifle as he shot at a tree stump two cables' lengths away, hitting it with remarkable consistency, so that Ali, with a spyglass, reported chips flying at almost every shot. He had his second piece at hand, waiting until Maturin should appear. Everyone was perfectly ready well before the hour, but everyone was equally certain that the Sultan, a foreigner, would be late. And they settled down to enjoy the indefinite waiting in the calm luxury of doing nothing in their best clothes and enjoying the breeze that now blew across the anchorage. It was with real astonishment, therefore, that they saw a two-hulled proa with a large deckhouse put off from the shore 40 minutes before the appointed time and advance, blowing conches and trumpets in a manner that would have been presumptuous in any but a ruling prince's vessel. Fox, almost the only person not yet in full glory, hurried below for his uniform, and Jack observed to his first lieutenant, "If some awkward sod had wanted the court to catch us with our breeches down, he couldn't have advised them better." Fielding glanced anxiously fore and aft. But everything seemed in order. The awning stretched just so, falls flemished, brasswork like that in a royal yacht, all hands shaved and in clean shirts, yards exactly squared. "Touching wood, sir," he said. "Perhaps the awkward sod may be disappointed. I believe we may receive all comers without a blush, but I'll just step below and put the doctor in mind of his coat and wig. The first comer was the Sultan himself, who, like nearly all Malays, came aboard in a seaman-like style, followed by his vizier, many of his council, and his cup-bearer. They were welcomed with the roar of guns, the howl of pipes, and the restrained splendour of a naval reception. On occasions of this kind, Fox and even his colleagues managed extremely well. They sat the guests under the awning, refreshed them with drinks judiciously laced with gin or brandy according to signals arranged beforehand, and helped Jack and Fielding show them round the ship. Jack was particularly struck by the Sultan's intelligent interest in all he saw, his grasp of the principles of naval architecture on the grander scale. For when Fox's perfectly fluent Malay ran dry on the subject of spurketing, hanging knees, brace bits and riding bits, the Sultan at once grasped Jack's explanation, chalked on the deck, and helped out with gestures. But it was the guns, the 18-pounders and the broad-mouthed carronades, the genuine short-range smashers, that really fascinated him and his followers. Even the vizier's benign, intelligent old face took on a predatory gleam. "Perhaps His Highness would like to see them in action," said Jack. His Highness would indeed. And the whole party went back to the quarter-deck. The reception had gone very well so far, and Jack was reasonably sure that it would go still better as soon as the ship was under way. Only Abdul would not be pleased. In spite of the fact that the envoy, now aware of the situation, had provided an unusually handsome present, Abdul had been froward from the beginning. And when drinks were being poured, he snatched a decanter from Killick's hands with a rudeness that would have brought him a shrewd box on the ear in any other circumstances. And now, aware that the Dianes didn't love him very much, he behaved with a petulant wantonness that made even confirmed old sodomites like the cook and the yeoman of the signal shake their heads. The Sultan himself had to stop him pulling the lanyard of one of the quarterdeck guns, and while the targets were being towed out and the cables buoyed and slipped, he capered about in a very offensive manner, openly despising Ali, Ahmed and the other Malay servants. Fox had left his two rifles on the capstan head when he hurried below, and now Abdul picked up the Purdy. He was very urgent to fire it. He was perfectly used to guns. He was an excellent shot, the best in Pulu Prabang after the Sultan, he said in a little boy voice. And to quieten him, Fox loaded, showed him how to hold the rifle and where to point. Abdul did not listen, did not cuddle the butt close, and the recoil hurt his cheek and shoulder. He burst into tears of pain and mortification. Ahmed had laughed aloud, and the Sultan, ludicrously concerned, tried to comfort him, but there was nothing to be done until Fox, yielding to very strong hints on the part of His Highness, gave Abdul one of his fowling pieces. The envoy put as good a face upon it as he could. The treaty was very dear to him, but his complacence was not very convincing, and it was a relief when the pipe of all hands to make sail brought the ship to active life, turning the general attention away from the nasty little scene. The evening breeze at Prabang was reasonably predictable, and at present it was behaving just as they'd hoped, blowing across the west-east line from the seaward gap and the crater rim to the town. The targets had been towed to their positions north and south of this line, and 400 yards from it, two to starboard, two to larboard. The Diane let fall her topsails, sheeted them home and hoisted the yards, bracing them to the steady breeze just abaft the beam. She gathered way remarkably fast, and Jack said to the master of the con, "Pray keep her 5 knots, Mr. Warren." She was to fire only the 11 forward guns of the main battery on either side, but here Fielding had concentrated all the frigate's talent, and he and Richardson, seconded by the 4 most responsible young gentlemen, were to supervise the firing. Not that there was any great need of supervision. The first and second captains of each gun thoroughly understood their business. Bonden, in charge of the starboard bow gun, had been pointing 24 or 18 pounders ever since the Battle of St. Vincent. And by now the picked crews were all well above the average for speed and accuracy. Since the Diane was new, well-built and strong, she could stand the shock of a simultaneous broadside, the most spectacular by far. But everyone concerned knew that this was an all-or-nothing affair, that no error could be corrected, and that they were being watched attentively by knowing eyes. Most had taken off their shirts, their best shirts embroidered in the seams, laying them carefully folded amidships or on the chain pump brakes, and most were a little nervous. For this kind of exercise, where the new flintlock might fail, Jack always preferred the old-fashioned slow match. And now its smoke eddied along the deck, awaking countless memories. The frigate was almost abreast of the first target, the water rippling along her side. "She bears," murmured Bonden. "Fire!" cried Fielding, and the whole broadside went off in an immense, long thundering crash. 11 jets of flame with wadding dark in the brilliance. And before the smoke bank rose to veil the sea, those on the quarterdeck saw the target leap in an eruption of white water, with a few plumes beyond it, and one shot that went skipping over the sea in great bounds until it hit the rocky shore. The Sultan's face was suffused with fierce delight. He pounded his right fist into his left palm in a European or perhaps a universal gesture and called out to the vizier, his eyes sparkling with the most unusual animation. Meanwhile, the teams were holding their guns inboard, sponging, reloading, ramming home the wad, and running the piece up with a fine, satisfying thump. The Diane approached the second target in dead silence. The gunners glared out of their gun ports with total concentration, making minute changes of bearing and elevation. The Sultan and his men lined the rail, motionless, wholly absorbed. "She bears," murmured Bonden again. And again, Fielding, peering along the barrel behind him, cried, "Fire!" This time there were no visible misses, and the Sultan laughed aloud. "Hands about ship," said Jack, and the frigate stayed in little more than her own length. The gun crews straightened for a moment, hoisting their trousers and spitting on their hands. They were now in perfect form, and bending to the guns again, they destroyed the two remaining rafts with a deliberate certainty. The Diane picked up her moorings once again by the two-hulled proa 12 minutes after she had left them. Jack and the returning First Lieutenant exchanged private glances of relief. It had been a somewhat perilous caper, but they knew that the ship had performed it well, even by the most professional standards. "Upon my word, sir," said Fox at his elbow, "that was a most impressive sight. The Sultan wishes you to know that he's seen nothing to equal it." Jack and the Sultan bowed and smiled to one another, and Jack, glancing at the setting sun, said, "Pray tell His Highness that in a few minutes I hope to show him something that may perhaps go beyond it, at least as an expression of loyalty. At one bell in the last dog watch, we are to fire a salute in honour of Princess Sophia's birthday." By one bell, the tropical dusk had become tropical darkness, and Mr. White stalked forth in his best uniform, a red-hot poker in his hand and a mate with a brazier behind him, and while the officers and marines stood to attention, and the hands to something faintly resembling it, he put the poker to the touch-hole of the first quarterdeck 9-pounder, which instantly shot out a vast tongue of crimson fire and a strangely shrill explosion. "Oh!" cried the Sultan in spite of himself, and repeating, "If I wasn't a gunner, I wouldn't be here," Mr. White paced on to the next. A jet of more than sapphire blue, and the whole court uttered a great "Ah!" The brilliant white of camphor, the green of brass filings, a rosy pink, a most uncommon violet derived from orpiment. And so it went at perfectly regular intervals, timed by the gunner's ritual words, to the final prodigious blast from the aftermost carronade, crammed with a deafening, blinding mixture of paddock, datang and colophony. Stephen saw the welcome light in Van Buren's window, and stepping over the python that was travelling along the outer path, he walked in by the garden gate. "How pleasant to see you again," they said almost simultaneously. And when Van Buren had described his journey, safely performed but slow, tedious and unrewarding from the point of view of natural philosophy, and his treatment of the patient, Stephen said, "By the way, there was a python in your lane. Reticulatus, I suppose." "I imagine so. There was neither time nor light to examine his labial scales, but I imagine so. 25 feet long, perhaps, and reasonably stout for a serpent of that length." "Yes, I see him from time to time. Pythons are said to be ill-tempered, but he's never proved objectionable, though perhaps it might not be wise to linger underneath his tree. Now, tell me, how have matters come along?" "As far as the official negotiations are concerned, they began well. But now they tend to become difficult with endless restatements of the case. Of course, they'll drag on for a great while. In these parts, a rapid conclusion would be a loss of consequence. I put Cuvier's bones for the very small, very delicate red ants to clean. A long task for them, considering the tapir's bulk. But I'm sure the bones will be perfectly white long before you carry them off to be sent to France. Oh, I should be happy to stay. They have scarcely begun on the Coleoptera, and I have never caught so much as a glimpse of an orangutan, even in the summit of a very distant tree. But what distresses me is that although with your invaluable advice and the help of the amiable Wanda, I have won the goodwill of the vizier and the greater part of the council, particularly the Sultana Hafsa's relations, every time Fox makes real headway, the Sultan imposes his veto and the vizier is obliged to overthrow everything, sometimes on pretexts that can hardly be attempted to be believed. And both Fox and I are convinced that this is because of Abdul. The Sultan has a strong, dominant character. His council is afraid of him. But as you said yourself some time ago, never was a man so besotted. It was embarrassingly obvious at the otherwise very successful reception aboard the frigate. But what interest can Abdul have in the matter? Have you met Ledward, the negotiator on the French side? I've seen him 2 or 3 times. A fine, upstanding figure of a man, though no doubt carrion. He is not only a very able, persuasive negotiator capable of out-talking Fox before the council and making him lose his temper, but he is also Abdul's lover. "Oh," said Van Buren, "that young man's playing with fire. Hafsa hates him, and her family's powerful. She's a determined woman herself, and the Sultan is of an extremely jealous disposition." "It is my belief," said Stephen after a pause, "that Ledward has made Abdul suppose that if they are put to their last shifts, the French will give their frigate as well as the guns, the subsidy and the shipwrights they offered in the first place. They've nothing else left. Their money is all gone. They had no great matter to begin with, and Ledward lost much of it in play. He is a furious and uniformly unfortunate gambler. So is his companion Ray. Will I tell you the reason for my belief? I should be very happy to learn it, but first let's drink a pot of coffee. Do you remember how I exulted over the rough drafts of Duplessis' journal?" asked Stephen, putting down his cup and wiping his lips. "'Twas the unwisest thing I ever did. Well, almost the unwisest. After a week, however, I did begin to feel that this was too easy and tiring, too handsome, to be honest. Now, I did tell you before you left that I intended to arrange for your gardener's half-brother to bring me the waste paper from Duplessis' house." "Certainly. The arrangement took some time, and the accumulation that eventually reached me when a discreet means of delivery had been contrived made a forbidding great heap. Still, I did flatten and class it all in time. And in time, I came across some rough drafts of the mission's journal. Doubt had been growing in my mind, and I was not altogether astonished to find that they were not the same as my alleged rough drafts of the same date. But I will confess that it vexed me extremely. Ledward is in charge of all the mission's intelligence, and I could see him laughing with Ray at my simplicity. Galling, oh, very galling, I'm sure. So galling that I didn't trust myself to act for some little while. Fortunately, Wu Han, to whom I confessed some part of my disappointment, felt himself, I'll not say responsible, but to some extent concerned or engaged. I should add that he thinks of moving to Java, a more fruitful field for his talents, and he is very willing to be well seen by Shao Yan and, of course, by Raffles. He questioned his clerk, whose good faith seems entire, bought his debt on my behalf, and made him invite Le Sœur that evening. Le Sœur came. I'm not the only simpleton in Prabang. And he was summoned to pay. Of course, he couldn't produce the money, and so he was seized as a debtor. Wu Hao has powerful porters for this kind of thing, and brought to me by night. He has no immunity of any kind. The Sultan gave safe conduct and promise of protection to the members of the mission as it was constituted in Paris. Le Sœur and other minor people were engaged in the East Indies. I represented to him that he had behaved very foolishly. He had not only ruined himself, since he would be kept in prison and scourged daily until he paid, but he had utterly wrecked the fortunes of his family and his mercantile household in British hands. He wept. He was exceedingly sorry. He had been forced into it by Mr. Ledward, who had found him abstracting papers after the first few days. I told him that his only hope of salvation was to say nothing whatsoever, to do what he'd undertaken to do, while at the same time sending me the false rough drafts as well. I had someone in the mission who would tell me if he did amiss, as I'd already been told on this occasion. So far he has not done amiss, and I have the advantage of knowing both what they have done and what they wish me to think they have done or are about to do. And one thing that they, or rather Ledward, wishes me to think, is that the French are prepared to throw their frigate into the scales in order to obtain their treaty. How would your thinking that profit him? I'm not sure. It might be in the hope that the rumour would spread from our mission, eventually reaching the Sultan's ear from various sources and thus gaining in credibility. It might be in order to reduce Fox to despair so that he should go away without any agreement. I don't know. But clearly it has floated into Ledward's mind, and I am persuaded he has made Abdul believe it. The door opened, and Mevrouw van Buren came in. She was little more than 5 feet tall, but she contrived to be elegant, slim, intelligent, and above all, cheerful. A quality Stephen valued highly. Most Malays tended to be morose, and many, many married women to be glum. He was very fond of her. They bowed to one another, smiling, and she said to her husband, "My dear, supper is on the table." "Supper?" cried Van Buren, amazed. "Yes, my dear, supper. We have it every evening at this time, you know. Come, it will be getting cold." "Oh," said Van Buren as they sat down, "I was forgetting. There was some post waiting for me when we came home. Nothing very interesting. The proceedings are filled with mathematical papers. And in the journal, that charlatan Klopf vapours away about these vital principles. But I was sorry to hear that the city of London was in such a turmoil and that there was a run on the banks. I do hope you're not likely to be injured." "Bless you, I have no money," said Stephen. Then recollecting himself, he went on, "That is to say, for many years my life was solitary, poor, nasty, brutish. And it would have been short if I hadn't continued to live. So poverty and solitude became quite habitual, the natural state. I think of myself as penniless, yet now, in fact, the case is altered. I have been blessed with an inheritance, which is, I may add, looked after by a banking house of unquestioned integrity. And what is much more to the point, I am no longer solitary. I have a wife. And by the time I return, I hope to have a daughter too. The Van Burens were touchingly pleased. They drank to Mrs. Maturin and her baby. And when the subject had been thoroughly handled, Mevrouw Van Buren said, "This brings in my news very happily. I've been bursting to tell you. The Sultana Hafsa is certainly with child, 2 months with child, and the Sultan is making a pilgrimage to Biliong to ensure that it shall be a boy. He promises to gild the dome of the mosque if he has an heir." "How long will the pilgrimage take?" asked Stephen. "With the journey and all the proper lustrations, 8 days, perhaps 9, since half the council necessarily go with him, leaving only the vizier and a few others to keep the peace and try current cases," said Van Buren. "I'm afraid your negotiations are at an end for at least a week." "I shall go to Kumai," said Stephen, with a shining face. On the way back to his bawdy house, he decided that in decency he must, alas, ask Fox to join him in the expedition. By the time he entered the lower Corsair Hall, he had composed a civil but not unduly pressing message. And as he was walking through to reach the upper, quieter regions where he could write it, he noticed Reed and Harper sitting with a group of middle-aged women. Their short legs were resting on other chairs. Each had a cheroot in one hand and a glass, probably of arak, in the other. Reed's pretty, smooth, round choirboy face was bright scarlet. Harper's something between grey and green. The sight puzzled him for a moment, but then he remembered that they had been sent ashore so that their morals shouldn't be damaged when girls were allowed on board. They didn't see him, their gaze being fixed on a lascivious dance in the middle of the room, and he passed through to the stairs. Having written his note, he came to their table, and when their eyes had at last focused on him, they started to their feet. Harper flushed red, little Reed turned deathly pale and pitched forward. Stephen caught him as he fell and said, "Mr. Harper, you are all right, are you not? Then be so good as to deliver this note into His Excellency's hands as soon as possible. Halim Shah," to the man of the house, "pray have the other young gentleman carried to Mr. Fox's residence without delay." The answer to his note came with the morning sun, and it was as welcome. Fox was désolé, but the Sultan had invited him to join the company going to Biliong by way of compensation for Ledward's presence during his visit to Kawang, and the envoy saw that it was his clear duty to accept for the sake of the treaty. He would go with death in his heart. Never was a pilgrimage more inopportune. Yet if Maturin would do him the great kindness of breakfasting with him, Fox could at least give a brilliantly intelligent eye some notion of the things to look for and measure in the Kumai temple. Aubrey would be breakfasting too, which might be an added inducement. "There you are, Stephen," cried Jack as he came in. "A very good morning to you. It's days since we met. I'm just going to flog those little brutes and shall be back very soon. Here's His Excellency." "For all its mortifying effects," said Stephen, as he and Fox sat down to their kedgeree, "you must admit that this invitation to Biliong is a great diplomatic coup. None of the French mission goes, I believe." "No, not one. I must draw what comfort I can from that." They talked for some little while about the journey, which, though by no means the great pilgrimage to Mecca, had many of the same strict ritual observances, and much of the same austerity and abstinence. Would the presence of concubines, or even of Abdul, be proper? "Oh, no," said Fox. "At the time of vows of this kind, chastity is absolutely required. Abdul will certainly not go." "Enter the righteous Sadducee," said Jack, walking in. The trouble with flogging boys is that you may maim them for life, which is unkind, or not really hurt them at all, which is ridiculous. Bosun's mates never seem to have any trouble. They lay on as though they were threshing out a bushel of beans and then put the cat away as calm as you please. Nor did old Pagan, my schoolmaster. Plagoso Orbilio, we used to call him. I tell you what it is, Excellency. You're no doubt a most capital diplomat, but you're a damned indifferent nursemaid. I never thought such things would enter their heads, said Fox sulkily. Public women, lewd girls. I'm sure they never entered mine at that age. Jack and Stephen looked down at their plates. And after a while, Fox begged Aubrey's pardon. His appointment at the palace was coming very close. And before he left, he had to tell Maturin about this temple he was going to see, the particular features to be observed, and, if possible, drawn and measured. They saw him off, wished him a happy pilgrimage, and went back to finish the coffee. "I wish I could come with you," said Jack, "but I cannot leave the ship. Yet since Van Buren says there is at least a bridle path to the crater wall, may I not ride with you that far? And then Seymour or Macmillan or both could be there whenever you appoint, leading a pony for you to come back on." The road inland wound along the Prabang River right across the alluvial plain, and on either hand people were working their partly flooded enclosures with buffaloes or setting rice plants. Weaver birds flew in clouds, and down by the water various kinds of duck moved in surprising quantities. Storks paced gravely in the paddies. "I believe that was a real snipe," cried Jack, putting his hand to his carbine. "And another, by God!" But Stephen was deeply engaged in a discussion of the sago palms that lined the road and filled the marshier parts with his guides, two sunny dyaks belonging to that part of the Sultan's bodyguard detached to look after the British mission. They were armed with spears and their traditional blowpipes, as well as krisses, and they were said to be quite fearless and deadly opponents. They were, of course, headhunters, and they were full of information about sago and most of the creatures that passed. One of them, Sadong, was a remarkably good shot, and being an amiable, obliging soul, he knocked down several of the more unusual birds for Stephen with his silent, accurate weapon, particularly after they'd left the cultivated ground and begun their long, steady climb through the open forest, following the tracks made by the Chinese who brought down sandalwood, camphor, and a number of the smaller trees used by cabinet makers. Well before noon, they sat under a spreading great camphor. Stephen skinned his birds, and the dyaks spitted them on twigs as an appetizer. Then they ate a cold roast peacock, brewed a pot of coffee, and set off in the hot, silent, shaded middle of the day. Nothing was moving. Even the leeches were somnolent. But the dyaks showed the recent tracks of two bears and the curious boar of these parts, and they pointed out a hollow tree in which the bears had obviously found honey, a tree with 36 kinds of orchid growing on it, some at a great height. The least spectacular was said to be useful in cases of female sterility. On and steadily up. Occasionally, when there was some exceptional thinning of the trees by lightning stroke or whirlwind or bare rock outcropping, the volcano could be seen coming closer and growing in height. And occasionally, in ravines or on open slopes, there were distinct traces of an ancient road, now reduced to a path where it was followed at all, but once broad, carefully planned, and embanked. The Dyak said that at its end there was a famous stand of durians esteemed for their size, flavour, and early ripening, and a heathen temple just before the Thousand Steps. "I've lost a stone," said Jack, leading his pony up the deep-worn track. "You could well afford it," said Stephen. On and up and up. Conversation drooped and eventually died quite away, Jack fairly aswim with sweat. Then all at once the path ceased climbing, and there was the durian grove on its fine stretch of flat ground. Beyond it, the grey wall of the crater soared up, the legendary steps catching the light, winding up and away like the Great Wall of China. They walked slowly across the little plain under the wide-spaced trees, and there, at the foot of the cliff, a cliff that now shut out half the sky, stood the Dyak's heathen temple, almost entirely ruined and buried under rampant vegetation. Figs, lianas, and surprisingly a dense group of tree ferns, but with part of one tower still standing. The rows of carvings on its outward face couldn't easily be made out. Time had obscured them, of course, but even more the iconoclastic zeal of Muslim converts. As far as tall ladders could reach, noses, sometimes whole heads, bosoms, hands, arms and legs had been beaten off. Yet enough remained to make it clear that this had been a Hindu holy place. And Stephen was trying to remember the name of the dancing figure with six arms, the remains of six arms, when he heard, "Oho, Mayas, Mayas!" from one Dyak and "Shoot, Twan, shoot!" from the other. He whipped round, saw Jack pulling the carbine from his saddle and the Dyaks pointing their pipes into a tall, leafy durian. Following the direction, he caught a fragmentary sight of a very large, rufous shape high up, and he called out, "Don't shoot, Jack!" At the same moment, Sadong launched his dart. There was a violent movement above, a waving of branches, the tearing of leaves, and a heavy spiked durian shot out of the tree, passing between the Dyak's heads. They fled, laughing, to a safe distance, and the orangutan fled in the other direction, swinging from branch to branch, tree to tree, at a surprising pace. Stephen had two glimpses of him, reddish in the odd patches of sun, immensely broad-shouldered and long-armed, and then he was gone. The Dyaks went to the tree and showed Stephen the empty remnants of fruit and the Mayas droppings. "There was a female here too," said Sadong, pointing. "I will see whether they've left anything at all." He climbed into the tree, called, "Very few, the fiends," and tossed down four of the ripest. When the durians were done, Stephen took his roll from behind the saddle, slung it over his shoulder and said, "You must go back at once, brother, or you'll be benighted in the forest. I shall have the sun much longer." "God help us," said Jack, gazing up at the steps, rising and rising forever. "What a climb! Just now I thought I saw someone a quarter of the way up, but either I was mistaken or he's turned the corner. Goodbye now, Jack. God bless. Dear Dyaks, goodbye." 100 steps, hollowed by 100 generations of pilgrims, each step dreadfully high. 200. Already the forest was one vast green sheet spread out, and somewhere there was a full-grown male orangutan moving about beneath the leaves. "I should have given £5 to have had time to see him properly," he said. And then, remembering his present wealth, "No, much more, very much more." 250 steps. And in a niche on the cliffside of the path, the image of some god had been sadly disfigured. 300, where the curve, always left-handed hitherto, became somewhat irregular, turned faster, and showed not only a new stretch of country with the river shining silver a great way off, but also another traveller far ahead. A traveller wearing a shabby brown blanket, it seemed. A weary traveller walking awkwardly, often on all fours where the steps rose steep, often resting. 350. Stephen tried to remember Pope's lines about the monument and the number of the tall bully's steps. Whatever that number, 400 of these had defeated Muslim zeal, since here, where a projecting spill of lava allowed the path to change direction, turning through 140 degrees, there stood a shrine untouched by violence, a dim, calm figure almost effaced by wind and rain, but still conveying serenity and detachment. The other traveller had rested by the shrine. Now they were closer together, not 200 yards apart. And now, with a mingled incredulity and bubbling delight, Stephen saw that the traveller was a Mayas, an orangutan. The incredulity vanished when he'd brought out his little pocket telescope, but the delight was tempered by a fear that the creature hadn't yet noticed him, that when it did so, it would tear away. To be sure, this was no country for a great arboreal ape to make a sudden disappearance, there being nothing but bare lava and a stunted bush or two. But even so, he kept his distance, watching the Mayas intently. He knew nothing of the ape's powers of hearing, sight or scent, and such a chance might never come again in 1,000 years. Up and up they went, still a cable's length apart, but slowly, for the ape was footsore and despondent. As for Stephen, by the 600th step, his calves and thighs were ready to burst. And at each rise now, they forced themselves upon his attention. Up and up, up and up, until the ridge was no great way off at last. But before they reached it, the path took another turn. And when he too came round the corner, he was on top of the ape. She was sitting on a stone, resting her feet. He scarcely knew what to do. It seemed an intrusion. "God be with you, ape," he said in Irish, which in his confusion seemed more appropriate. She turned her head and looked him full in the face. Her expression was sad, weary, in no way hostile, remote. A falcon passed low overhead. They both watched it out of sight, and then she heaved herself up and went on, Stephen following. He took the most particular notice of her progression, her muscular movements, the paucity of the gluteus maximus, the odd disposition and contraction of the gastrocnemius, and on the other hand, the prodigious breadth of shoulder and the very powerful great arms, clearly an animal made for moving among trees. They were on the ridge at last, the crater's lip, and before going over and down, she looked at him again with what he thought a happier, even a friendly look. He stayed for some moments, letting the pain ebb away from his legs, and taking in this wholly unexpected scene. A vast bowl, miles and miles across, with a lake in the middle, a much gentler slope down the inside, trees almost to the top, a landscape of mixed forest interspersed with bamboo groves and wide stretches of grass, particularly by the lake. And down, far down on his left, the Kumai Temple, a wisp of smoke rising from a building at its side. From where he stood, there was only a path leading down, and a faint one at that. No steps were needed on this moderate fall. But the ape had left it. She was already among the low trees, swarming along with vast heaves, scarcely touching the ground, and soon not touching it at all. He saw her shabby red-brown coat vanish among the leaves, travelling straight and fast towards the monastery where someone was beating on a gong. He arrived himself as dusk was falling. Much of the temple was ruined, but the severe broad front was whole as well as a large hall behind it, a hall from which a thin, remote chant could be heard. Across this front stretched what, for want of the proper term, Stephen thought of as a portico, a narthex. And in this narthex, a monk in a worn old saffron robe was sitting by a brazier. He stood up as Stephen emerged from the trees, reaching the open grass before the temple, and came forward to welcome him. "Will you take a cup of tea?" he asked, proper greetings having been exchanged. Ordinarily, Stephen took no great delight in that insipid wash, but the 1,000 steps had reduced his pride, and he accepted most thankfully. As they walked back and mounted the narthex steps, oh, so painfully, he observed that the Mayas was sitting on the other side of the brazier. Not indeed on a stool, like the monks, but in a kind of tilted, basket-worked nest. Her feet had obviously been washed in a basin of warm water, and there was blood on the cloth. Nevertheless, the monk said, "Mwang, where are your manners?" And the ape rose high enough to bow. Stephen returned the bow and said, "Mwang and I came up the 1,000 steps together." "Did she indeed go so far down as the Durians?" asked the monk, shaking his head. "I had supposed she was only walking on the higher slope for tilak berries. No wonder her poor feet are so torn. She too will be the better for a cup of tea." The ape had looked anxiously from face to face during this conversation, but at the word tea her visage brightened, and from the recesses of her basket she drew out a bowl. While the monk, whose name was Ananda, was making the tea, and while they were all three drinking it, Stephen studied Mwang's face. Its varieties of expression were difficult to make out, but presently he could distinguish several, particularly the look of deep affection that she often directed towards the monk. The chanting inside the temple stopped. The gong sounded 3 times. "They are about to meditate," observed Ananda. Now night was coming fast. A final chorus of gibbons went hoo, hoo, hoo at great length in the forest below, and 2 of them hurried across the grass in front of the narthex, one with its hands clasped behind its neck, the other with its arms held high. The monk brought a lamp, and at once it lit up a mouse deer and her tiny fawn. Mwang's eyes had closed. She was wheezing comfortably. "I'm sorry that she went so far," said Ananda. "It is too much for an ape of her age." "Perhaps she is very fond of durians." "She is. But there are plenty here, and some are ripe. No, she goes down there to see a male orangutan, but she's old, and he scorns her. She comes back tired and sad, her feet torn, her coat quite matted." "Are there no orangutans here?" "Oh, yes, plenty, plenty, but they will not do. The only one for her is that animal below. She's friendly with her cousins here. They visit her quite often, but none can be looked upon as a mate." They talked about her for some time, and it appeared that more years ago than he could remember, the count of years was lost up here, when Ananda was a newly arrived novice, he had found her, a suckling, her mother dead, presumably from a snake bite, and he'd brought her up on ewe's milk. She couldn't actually speak, but he was quite sure that she could understand at least 200 words and could follow the drift of any ordinary conversation. She was very affectionate in a quiet, gentle way, and if she hadn't been so tired that evening, Stephen would have seen that she had pretty manners. She always wiped her mouth after drinking, for example, and she could eat with a spoon. At moonrise, Ananda brought him a bowl of cold brown rice with salted green durian as a relish, and when it was eaten, asked him, the first personal question since they met, where he would like to sleep. The room above this had once been called the Pilgrim Chamber, but that was very, very long ago, and now the bats might be an inconvenience. Yet, on the other hand, sleeping down here exposed one to serpents who loved to share one's warmth, and to porcupines. "If Mwang doesn't dislike it," said Stephen, who had seen her busily and very exactly spreading a square of litter at the far end, "I'm sure I shall not." He had always understood that nothing in the vast and effectively sacred Kumai crater was ever killed by men, and hadn't been so killed since the beginning of the Buddhist era. Yet, although he'd had some small experience of this immunity during his time in Hindu India, where vultures would sit on the roof or squabble in the busy street, and where monkeys walked in at the window, he was astonished by what he saw. Before he went to sleep, half the ark, half the fauna of Pulaprabang walked by in the moonlight, or sat scratching themselves on the broad expanse of grass. Once in the night he was woken by a huge, sweet-breathed creature blowing on his face. But by that time the moon had set and he couldn't identify it. Then in the early light, when first he raised his head, there was an orangutan nonchalantly leaving the narthex where it had presumably called on Muang. And the dewy grass was crisscrossed with innumerable tracks. When next he sat up, he observed that Muang had already left. Her bedding was ranged neatly behind a row of stones, and that his legs were quite extraordinarily stiff. He rubbed them, listening vaguely to the chant within and watching the sun's light travel down the mountainside. The sky was already a full soft blue, and the gibbons had been hooting this half hour and more. The light reached a noble tree that he took to be a liquid ambar. The chant seemed to be moving to a close. He stood up, still bent, and felt in his roll for the offerings that Liu Liang himself, a Buddhist in the Chinese manner, had told him would be acceptable. A long, thick, silk-skinned sausage of delicate tea, a long, thick, leather-skinned sausage of benzoin. He washed his face in the remaining dew, pushed his roll into a shape at least as neat as Mong's, and sat on the narthex steps eating a ship's biscuit. The chanting stopped. The gong boomed, and the door opened, a shaft of sunlight showing the great stone figure at the far end of the temple, a calm, harmonious figure with its right hand raised, palm outwards. The five choir monks came out, led by their tall, lean abbot. Stephen bowed to them, and they to Stephen. Ananda appeared with tea and several bowls. Everyone sat on the ground, and Stephen proffered his silk parcel, saying, "An unworthy offering to an ancient house," and his leather parcel, "To an ancient house, an unworthy offering." The abbot patted them with detached pleasure, returned thanks, and waited, drinking his tea sip by sip. After a decent interval, Stephen gave a short account of himself. He was a medical man, a naval surgeon, brought into these parts by the war between England and France. Apart from medicine, his greatest interest was living things and their way of life. He also had a friend who was deeply concerned with the first spread of Buddhism and the remaining early temples. Stephen therefore hoped he might be permitted to look at Kumai, measure it, draw it as far as his powers allowed, and to walk about the country for a few days to observe its inhabitants. "Certainly you may look at our temple and draw it," said the abbot. "But as for the animals, there is no killing here. We eat rice, fruit, and such things. We take no life." "I have no wish to kill anything here, only to observe. I have no weapons at all." While the abbot was considering this, another monk, who had been gazing at Stephen through his spectacles, said, "So you are an Englishman?"
"No, sir," said Stephen.
"I am an Irishman. But for the moment, Ireland is subject to England and therefore at war with France." "England and Ireland are small islands on the farthest western extremity of the world," said another monk. "They are so close together that they can scarcely be distinguished. Birds flying at a great height may land on the one rather than on the other, but in fact England is the larger." "It is true that they are close together, and that it is not always easy to distinguish them from a great distance. But then, sir, the same applies to right and wrong. Good and evil are so close at times," observed the abbot, "that there is scarcely the breadth of a hair between them. But as for the animals, young man, since you undertake not to do any harm, you may certainly walk among them. Muang will show you her friends among the Mayas, and there are quantities of swine, as well as all the gibbons and their kind, and medicinal plants in great variety.
Yet, like all pilgrims, you're stiff and bent after the thousand steps. Ananda will take you to our hot baths, and then today you will draw the temple and measure it. Tomorrow you will be supple and reposed. There were few carnivores in Pula Prabang, no tigers at all, and fewer still at Kumai. Some pythons were to be found, and they had to make a living. But 3 months between meals were not unusual for them, and neither they nor the odd small cats, still less the honey bears, created that perpetual half-conscious wariness and apprehension among the peaceful animals that made them so nervous and difficult to watch in most other parts. But above all, they had not been persecuted by men for 1,000 years, and they took no more notice of human beings than of cattle. And Stephen found to his stupefaction that he could walk through a herd of rusa, pushing his way where they stood thick as though he were one of themselves. He could offer the mouse deer's fawn a green frond growing too high, and it wouldn't hesitate for a moment. Although the comparatively few birds were a little more diffident, no doubt because being airborne they were more experienced, very few other creatures could manage the bare, steep, shaly outer crater wall, and it had only the single gap by the 1,000 steps. But even so, they sometimes perched on him, and the whole effect was very like being in a waking dream of losing human identity, or even of being invisible as well as wonderfully supple and reposed after hours in the 3 basins hollowed in the rock and fed by 3 faintly sulphurous springs, each hotter than the last. The grazing animals it was that took least notice of him. The swine, there were 2 kinds, were curious, sometimes embarrassingly so, and playful. But it was the primates, the golden and the proboscis monkeys, and above all, the orangutans that showed most interest. The orangutans were gentle, placid, rather lethargic creatures upon the whole, not particularly sociable and not at all gregarious. Muang never showed him more than 5 at once, 2 sisters and their young. But they often came down from the flattish nests in which they spent so much of their time and sat with him and Muang, looking earnestly into his face. Their lips pursed and thrust forward as though they were going to whistle, and sometimes, gently touching him, his clothes, his meagre hair, his pallid, almost naked arm, their hands, though scaly, were quite warm. Once, it was a perfectly enormous old male that came down by a liana as thick as a cable and sat at the foot of his tree with them. He was old. He had the expanded cheek pads and the throat pouch of the aged Mayas, but none of the peevishness and ill nature so usual in the elderly. He positively caressed Stephen's shoulder before going up his liana again with a swing as light and easy as a top man for all his prodigious weight. What communication there was between Muang and her friends he couldn't make out, though he tried hard. Sound audible to him had little to do with it. A small vocabulary of grunts, and he could only suppose that it was a matter of the language of eye and minute change in expression. Whatever it was, she knew where they were and how from a distance to invite them to come down from their trees or through a bamboo grove. Those he most attentively watched were the 2 sisters, both rather a fine red, and their half-grown, playful, very active young. They spent much more time on the ground, and he stayed with them for hours together, hoping he would remember all he observed. But Muang didn't really approve of this frequentation, and gradually it was borne in upon him that she thought the children tiresome and the young mothers rather discreditable, even common. Indeed, it was his insistence upon going to see the group on his last day that led to their only disagreement. Muang knew perfectly well what he wanted, and by now he knew perfectly well from her expression that she wasn't pleased. Still, when both Ananda and he asked her to do so, she did lead him to the far side of the lake, sometimes going along with her knuckles to the ground when they reached the open grassy slope, sometimes leaning on his arm. The family band was there, where a tongue of trees ran almost to the water, And that was where Muang left him, obviously intending to go home alone. The twins, lighter and more spidery than their one-at-birth cousin, were guarding the top of a boulder from him, a great rounded grey boulder at the edge of the water. With boundless energy, the little apes attacked, repelled, fell onto the muddy shore or into the water, splashed, and began again. Apart from some muted gibbering, they were remarkably quiet for perhaps half an hour. But then, in an excess of zeal, one bit another's ear. They all fell into the lake screeching. The mothers came rushing down, oaths, reproaches, blows, reddish hair torn out, and the game ended with the whole group shambling off over the grass and into the trees. From his discreet observation post, not a hiding place at all, but a comfortable tussock that gave him a general view, Stephen watched them disappear and then looked back to the boulder to estimate the orangutan's ordinary, unhurried, quadrupedal speed over a moderate slope. But as it travelled, his eye was caught by an object that stopped his breath, that almost stopped his heart, and that banished all thought of calculation. What he had hitherto taken for another grey boulder was, in fact, a rhinoceros. Rhinoceros unicornis. A male by his long single horn and his size, something between 16 and 17 hands, though that was difficult to judge because of the huge bulk below its withers and the relative shortness of its legs. Three birds were perched upon its back. Without moving from his tussock, Stephen brought out his spyglass. He was filled with a sudden, illogical caution, and as well as he could with his shaking hands, he focused it upon the rhinoceros. Since the animal wasn't much above 100 yards away, this brought it very close indeed, so close that Stephen saw it close its eyes. It appeared to him that the rhinoceros had recently been wallowing. Mud was drying on its massive back, and that on leaving the muddy shore it had gone to sleep there, facing up the grassy slope a little way from the lake. The final outburst of the orangutans had woken it. Now it was going to sleep again. But this was a mistaken view. The rhinoceros was thinking. Presently it opened its eyes again, breathed in and out with enormous force, raised its head, sniffed the air from right to left, brought its ears to bear and set itself in motion. Surprisingly buoyant motion for such a solid mass, going straight up the hill. And as he watched, Stephen understood its reputation of shocking strength and savagery, disemboweling elephants, devastating thorn breaks for hours on end out of mere blind fury and malignance, tossing bulls as though they were footballs. The speed increased. The thick, short legs fairly twinkled as the creature ran, gathering impetus. Looking beyond, Stephen saw another rhinoceros at the top of the slope, quarter of a mile away. It too was male. It too was running at the same smooth, powerful, very rapid pace. At the halfway point they converged, and half turning met shoulder to shoulder in a blow that sent up a cloud of dust. But neither staggered, and each completing its turn they came down abreast, faster and faster still, straight for him. The ground trembled shockingly. Stephen leapt to his feet. And then, with a great trampling, rushing din, they were past, racing towards the lake. Within a yard of its edge, they wheeled together, wheeled as quick as boars, and raced up the hill again, shoulder to shoulder, their hooves twinkling in time as they crossed the ridge and disappeared.